this is Archer Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you that views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and of course the views of our callers. But this evening, right now, we have with us Melody Cederstrom, and we're going to be talking about what's going on in the world today, and, of course, how this is impacting on every one of you out there. Good evening, Melody. How are you doing?
I'm just fine, Dr. Stan. Thank you very much.
Well, you know, we've been talking for quite a while about what's going on in the world and trying to warn people that something big was going to happen economically, and, you know, you just... We're just on the edge of this right now. Have you noticed what's happening to the Chinese stock market? I mean, apparently over there in China, why it's hard to get a doorman or a maid, you know, living in the big cities. They're all out there playing the stock market. It's just like it was back in 1929 in America. You got all these people, unsophisticated people, and they see other people making a fortune in the Chinese stock market, and these Chinese people, ordinarily Chinese, are really very frugal and really pretty smart people, but they're all playing the stock market. They're making money like it's just going out of style, just like it was here in 1929.
You're absolutely correct. They've got the fever, and it isn't gold fever, and I, too, believe that they will follow and have the same problems as our country faced during the boom and bust and going into a major depression. And there's a lot of things coming out of China that you don't hear too much about. I was reading an article today about farmers, the rural people who are upset with number one, the population control that they have over there, and they've even taken to rioting. And so those that haven't been affected by the trickle down, and the ones that haven't had the opportunity to take advantage of the wealth that has hit China, they're not very happy. So there's going to be a lot of internal problems that China's going to face, but they're all in the stock market. Their banking industry is very is not very good. It has a lot of problems that they will face in the near future. I saw today where they sentenced one of their higher business. I'm not quite sure what his title was.
I think he was in charge of food safety, and he was taking payoffs to certify food and toothpaste, and whether he was involved with this melamine scandal recently that hit America, I don't know. But I mean, they have a very effective means of dealing with bureaucrats who take bribes. I mean, he was sentenced immediately to death, and that gets people's attention.
Well, they actually put someone to death a couple years ago that took bribes. And so, I mean, they do follow through. So I guess on one hand it puts a little bit of fear in the population, but as they become more westernized, they're going to want the same things that we have over here. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, but I do know one thing. It will not be beneficial to the people here in the United States.
Well, we're going to be back in just a moment with Melody Cederstrom and talking really what's happening throughout the world economically. Well, over in Japan, apparently, Chris, the banking system has been just lending money right and left. They got over $1 trillion of non-serviceable loans. In other words, $1 trillion of money that they've loaned out and they're never going to be able to get it paid back at the banks. And, of course, you know, they've been trying to run an economy in an authoritarian society like we would run our economy over here. And, of course, there are going to be real problems with that. People are beginning to expect better living standards. Prosperity is, you know, in the major cities is just, you know, everywhere manifestations of it. And unfortunately, there are not going to be a lot of people who have no idea how the world economic system works. You're going to find out that, you know, there is no free lunch, and I'm afraid a lot of these people are going to lose everything and going to end up impoverished, and there'll be even more unrest. But here in the United States, all the things we've been talking about, the housing bubble has burst. We're down almost to, I think, 10% in the housing sales here. Certainly a lot of the hedge funds have been buying up these housing loans, and of course highly leveraged, and of course those loans stop being serviceable. In other words, people stop paying their interest on them, then the hedge funds are going to start getting into trouble, and then the derivatives that guarantee the hedge funds are going to start getting into trouble, and all of the various things that we saw before that were taking us to the edge of the precipice to the financial tsunami are coming to pass. And that stock market just keeps going up. You don't have to know anything at all. You invest your money in the stock market, you're going to make money. I mean, you can take a dart and throw that at the pages of the Dow Jones, you're going to make money. But, of course, not indefinitely.
What people don't understand is they're not investing anymore. They're gambling. And it's not just here in the States. It's worldwide. Just as you talked about China and Japan, and it just goes on and on. There is and will be even greater worldwide inflation. Japan warns about food that is being used in biofuels, so that's causing their food prices to rise, you know, because they're using their crops to try to fuel motor cars. And so, you know, a lot of these soybeans for Japan is... the price on food is going to rise, just like what we've seen here in the States with corn and to, you know, all the way down to the tortillas in Mexico. The stock markets, the only thing that's fueling this...
Hold that stuff. We'll be back here in just a moment with Melody. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're just talking about the stock market going up. The price of everything is going up. In fact, right now, of course, according to Bob Chapman, he figures we've got an 11 or 12% increase in the M3 every year. The reason they're not publishing it isn't because they don't know how. They don't want the American people to know that they're destroying the value of their currency 11 or 12% every year. And of course, with the credit probably even going up to 13-14%. But, you know, you got your money in the stock market, you're making great money, and everybody thinks they're so smart. Go ahead, pick up the story there, Melody.
What people don't understand is that the reason that the market is going up, it's all based on debt. It's not that these companies are financially sound, and it's not the production of these companies, and it's not the great financial sheets that are moving the stocks that are listed in the Dow, S&P, and the NASDAQ. It's all debt. Today, it's amazing. IBM buys back $12.5 billion in stock. And what's truly interesting is that $11.5 billion of that is borrowed funds from three banks. So again, that money, it's all debt money. It's, you know, it is amazing. You have private equity firms that are piling on so much debt under the companies that they buy that some of them are left with hardly enough cash to make their interest payments. And the leverage levels at this point, it's been 7 years ago. And we know what happened 7 years ago with the telecommunications and technology companies. they all collapsed under a pile of debt. So not only do we have corporate debt, we have governmental debt, we have personal debt, and it just, I mean, we say this week in, week out, I say it day after day, it just can't continue. Because, you know, the piper will have to be paid, and but you keep seeing articles, all this debt, and that's the only thing that is making the stock markets rise. It's all debt.
Well, because they're doing this by tremendous liquidity. I mean, they just keep pumping out more and more and more money, and all of the various countries in the world are doing this because there is nothing behind it.
No.
I mean, none of this money has any real value. It's all paper. At one time, of course, countries had to act responsibly because their paper was tied to gold. But so if they actually got too far behind, they would have to either devalue or increase the value of their currency, depending upon what their gold stores were. And then, of course, if let's imagine their currency was too high. Why, of course, and too much in value. Why, then, of course, people would be coming in and buying up the gold. And sometimes it's a little hard to remember how this whole thing works, but eventually countries begin to lose gold, and then they would have to, of course, to lower the value of the currency when the value of the currency went up. They had more gold, and anyway, they had to get it back into some sort of a balance. And so it was... What we've done is we've got these ships at sea in the middle of a storm with no anchor, and everybody's competing to turn out more and more and more money, and that way they can buy all these goodies from the other countries. China is artificially keeping the value of its currency low so it can sell things here to us. We're keeping the value of our currency artificially high so we can buy all of these things, but one of the days the piper's going to have to be paid. And when it does, there's going to be tremendous financial repercussions in this country and throughout the world. And did you see that fascinating article in Foreign Affairs magazine talking about the ultimate solution? The new global currency that will be privately issued and backed by gold.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought that was the most fascinating concept, and they mentioned it not once but twice. A privately issued gold currency. And after all, you know, he who issues a currency, why, controls the world.
That's absolutely correct. But when you have all these, I mean, if you look at the passage, you look at their agenda and where they want to go, and you have all these countries that are jockeying for position of power and wealth, and basically, I mean, I truly believe, I mean, they took all the people's money, they're going to take all the corporate money, and they will have to have a unit of trade that will be acceptable within or around the world for all these countries. And the uncertainty and the scary part is what's going to happen for them to have these countries accept this unit of trade around the world. So, and absolutely, we know how the rest of the world thinks about gold. The only countries that are not actively pursuing gold is the Europeans and Canadians and the Americans. So, but around the world, they understand because they've all been through currency situations. They understand that they need to have gold, and so it all comes back to leveling the playing field, and you know, bringing the third world countries up and lowering our standard of level, so it's all equal. And that's what Wall Street's all about. They want your money; they're not going to allow you to have it. Some people get lucky. Maybe some get luckier than others, but the majority of people will lose a large percentage, if not all, of their funds that they have in Wall Street. And I truly believe that when that will happen, I don't know, but I do know with each day passing, it gets closer and closer.
Well, the one the significant thing, Melody, is the fact that you might have, I say, $100,000 invested in Wall Street, and you might get out $120,000. But it would be what that $120,000 will buy, not that it's $120,000. That $120,000 might buy, you know, five new cars, or it might buy you a loaf of bread.
Yeah.
And that, of course, is what nobody is telling you. I think one of the biggest pieces of news that came out this last week was when Argentina and Brazil announced that they were going to stop trading in dollars, and they were going to begin shifting to some sort of a basket of currencies based upon the currencies in South America and hope to begin to draw in the other countries. This could be the first step to the demise of the dollar as the reserve currency of the world. Did you pick up that story?
I saw where the Canadian, David Dodge, I think it was the first of last week, came out and did talk about the North American currency that they've acknowledged of creating a common currency. And this was the first time that they had spoke about it to the Canadians, or any articles that were written to where they would the North America would move towards a Euro-style currency. And but what's interesting, though, is you have to remember all these countries that are dropping the dollar and wanting to trade in their own baskets of currencies, they're all fiat currencies. So they're going to have the same problem with, you know, inflation and with the falling value, because they're all, it's all digits.
You're absolutely
right. It's not real.
And that's why I think that these local currencies that will be, you know, a basket of currencies are simply a transition stage to what is planned down the line. And the fact that the prestigious Foreign Affairs magazine would publish an article calling for a international gold-backed, privately issued currency, I think is one of the most intriguing things, because, you know, if you notice, all the central banks are selling gold. I mean, you know, 550 million tons and 100 million tons. I asked Bob Chapman the other day. I said, Bob, you know, they had another sale, 50 million tons of gold, central banks, and, you know I didn't buy that. I'm sure you didn't buy that. In fact, I don't know very many people who could buy 50 tons of gold. Who's buying it? And Bob said, well, the big boys, they're moving that gold into their own vaults. Well, then, of course, you ask yourself, if they're really thinking about a privately issued gold-backed currency, who's going to be issuing it? These same fellows who are laying in the gold. Right now, the gold of the world to back the currency that they're going to issue, and, of course, it'll be a fractional reserve currency. They'll they'll have a certain amount of gold, and they'll probably issue 10 times that much currency, but it'll be at least gold-backed, and they'll be responsible for having it available. It'd be the greatest scam of the world. They could even use some of the exchange-traded funds. But if this should happen, why, of course, the price of gold will go right through the roof.
Well, it's interesting, because how is China? I mean, is China going to accept this unit of trade? I mean, I know, I believe they're buying oil from Iran with the euro, and I believe the euro was just originally set up to have the, you know, it was just another part of the change out in bringing it closer to that one unit of trade for that private currency. I believe the euro was just a test market. You know, I mean, it was just, you know, something to have something as an alternative that is barked. That is backed partially by gold, just to see the acceptance. And I truly believe that was just a test.
Well, because, you know, the rate of inflation over in Germany is about 2.5% a year. The rate of inflation, the true rate of inflation here, is 12-13%. So, you know, their currency is far more stable than ours. And because they would represent the central bank of Europe, but whether or not they're going to be able to hold it, I don't know, because most of the other countries over there are not as well disciplined as the Germans are. We're on the edge of, in my estimation, a financial collapse. everybody should get their house in order, and all we can do is just wait and watch and pray. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. We'll pick the story up there, Melody.
Well, I agree with you. I believe we're on the edge. But one thing I want to...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Teary. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
One triple eight two four liberty or 464-8295. It's interesting over in Japan why both Toyota and Nissan have had to cut dramatically back on their domestic production. Now their sales in the United States are still doing fairly well, but in Japan itself, representing the economy there, why, of course, they've cut back dramatically on their production of automobiles in April because they're just not selling them over there. The Japanese people have been in a depression going back to about 1990, 1991, and nothing's changed. They've got an interest rate down less than 1%, and they still can't get their economy going again. And this is what happens after a tremendous blow-off, as they had at that time. At one time, the property, you know, in the city of Tokyo was worth more money than all the land in the United States together. Now, it wasn't really worth it. It was simply all a mirage, but people were willing to do it. The Japanese came over here. They bought the Empire State Building, but they bought Rockefeller Center. They bought the 17-mile drive golf course over here. They bought Pebble Beach. They were buying up America. And of course, in recent years, they were selling the Rockefeller Center, the Empire State Building, and of course the Pebble Beach Golf Course, because the whole house of cards came tumbling down. And Japan has never recovered from their depression back in 1990, 1991. And I fear the same thing is going to happen here very shortly, despite all the fact that we're still pumping out the money, and one of these days they're going to have to stop doing that, either that or completely destroy the value of the currency. So anyway, of course, what do you hear from your customers? Are they most of them quite concerned about what's going on? Are they just the steady customers you've always had?
Well, we have a lot of steady customers. They understand the uncertainty out there, and they want to protect against that. Most of them probably have, you know, close to 80 to 90% of their funds in gold and silver. Usually we have a lot of, I'll call them mainstream buyers. Usually when you have a little bit of a pullback in the dollar and gold moving, you know, maybe $5, $10 like we saw in early part of May, in the April and May of this year, and of course last year, to where they just want gold. You know, they understand the value, and there are more and more radio programs around the country that are talking about gold, and so their gold is becoming a little bit more known. But in fact, there are also some mainstream financial brokers that are also talking about gold, just like the hedge funds. And 40 to 50%, I believe, in this country are somehow involved in the markets, whether through their employment or majority of it is through their employment mutual funds. We don't need the amount of people in the market to get involved in gold. We only need about 1.5% of those investors to become interested in gold, as you were talking about the hedge funds, because there's so little gold out there. And if we had 1% of the investors get into the market, a lot of product, a lot of coins would be hard to come by. And then we enter in the law of supply and demand, which would certainly raise the price of gold and silver significantly. So the new customers, I don't think they quite understand it. They're coming into it more as an investment than really understanding that it's money, that it's real, and that it's a real currency. But I think they will eventually understand, and as we try to educate them along the way.
All right, so I'll let you get your telephone number out and your website.
I can be reached at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188.
And your website is?
The website is discountgoldandsilvertrading.net, discountgoldandsilvertrading.net.
All right, fine. Of course, our guest is Bill D. Cederson. We're talking about the things that are happening, the tragic things that are happening to our country. What's the leading economic force in the world? Today, America's the largest debtor nation in the world. And we're totally dependent upon the Chinese communists and the Japanese to buy up our debt. And, of course, the Japanese buy our debt because we've got our troops stationed in their country. And they jolly well better do that. Of course, we've controlled them since the time of the Second World War. Well, this is Dr. Stanback here. Unfortunately, the history tells us that any time a country consistently refuses to balance its budget, sooner or later it gets into real problems, and we're getting into real problems, and we're spending more and more money. The people in Washington, D.C. refuse to act responsibly. Even Alan Greenspan in his last week or so has said that there's about a 30% chance of a recession this year. A 30% chance of a recession this year. And Alan Greenspan and several of the others expressed their real concern about the stability of our currency and the survivability of our economy. And ladies and gentlemen, when these people began warning us, you better heed what they're saying. So pick the story up there, Melody.
And I'm sure when Alan Greenspan said that, I mean, he's on the low side on the 30% chance of a recession. We're already in a recession, but, you know, it takes them a year or so until they'll actually admit it and until they say their numbers, point to that. But our government, I mean, they've recorded a $1.3 trillion loss last year, and it just continues to rise. And I was reading an article, it was in the USA Today, and we know they're hiding trillions of dollars in debt, and we're right back to the debt situation. And again, it's just not here in this country, it's everywhere. And the article was saying that each household, the taxpayers, are now on the hook for a record of $59 trillion in liabilities, a 2.3 increase from 2006. And that equals to over $516,000 for every U.S. household. And sometimes I think these numbers are just so high that people just can't grasp the degree of the situation and how and what it can do. You talked about Japan, how they came in and bought America out. They were buying all different properties. Well, China is doing the same as what Japan did. I believe, was it a week or so ago, they bought an interest in Blackstone, I believe, off the top of my head. I think it's Blackstone. And they couldn't buy any of our oil companies. If you remember a year ago, there was all the politicians did all their pre-election day scrambling.
Hold that stuff. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening, Melody Cederstrom. Our telephone number, if you'd like to call us, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY 464-8295. 1-888-24-LIBERTY 464-8295. Now, how do you impoverish a great country like ours? Well, you begin to sell off all the manufacturing. And right now, about 25% of the manufacturing in the United States has been purchased by foreign countries. Westinghouse, certainly a name that's just as, well, as American as apple pie. Well, it's a Japanese apple pie right now because Westinghouse is a Japanese company. The states, many of them, are having real problems meeting all the financial obligations, the pension funds that they've promised to pay. They don't have the money. How are they going to pay all the teachers? If they don't pay the teachers, retired, they'll be out demonstrating. They don't get their money. They don't get their health benefits. Same thing with the police and firemen and other state employees. So they're beginning to sell off the infrastructure of our society. They're beginning to sell off the Chicago Skyway, the New Jersey Turnpike, the Ohio Turnpike, the various dams. There certainly are major highways. So this major highway that they're going to build through the heartland of Texas, the so-called Texas Trans-Texas Highway, was to be built by Centrum, a Spanish company. And, of course, all of these foreign companies have lots of dollars. Why? Because we've been spending them like they were going out of style. And now, of course, what do you do with them? You don't want to hang on to them because the dollar is falling in value. The dollar is going to have to fall another 50% before it'll get back down to its real value. In other words, it's way overpriced now. That gives us the ability to buy a lot of things cheap. But the dollar is not worth, you know, what it's valued at on the world market. So if you are a foreigner and you hold dollars, what are you going to do with them? Well, you're going to dump them and put them into something that has intrinsic value. And if you've got too many of them, well, you're going to come to America and start buying up land. You're going to come to America and start buying up factories. You're going to come to America and start buying up infrastructure. And then the profits that you make off of this, off of the backs of the Americans, will actually be sent back to your country, back to your stockholders. And this is what is happening in America today. And the average American, well, things aren't so bad. People get a little irritated when they hear people talking about what's going on. They don't want to think that the America we know is no longer going to exist. That our leaders have betrayed us. Our leaders are actually allowing foreigners to come in and simply buy up many of our major corporations. And they already, as I said earlier, owe 25% of our major manufacturing, and pretty soon it's going to be 50%. And then it'll be 75%. And it's just exactly what we have done to other countries, third world countries throughout the world, as we forced them further and further into debt. And then to service their debt, of course, they had to enslave their people and raise the taxes, and they could never possibly pay off all the debt that they owed. Well, what goes around comes around, I'm afraid. And those of you who have not read The Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins or heard our four-tape set on Economic Hitman must get a copy of that and read it, because very, very similar things are beginning to happen right here in the United States. And they're happening not by accident, but because of the betrayal of our leaders, who have a different worldview, whose loyalty is not to America, but to the internationalist dream. And their goal is to impoverish the American people and lower our living standards. And, of course, a large part of that is going to be the oil. Oil's up to almost $70 a barrel now. And, of course, it's going to continue going up, I believe. It's not that there's a shortage of oil, but, of course, they're going to keep rising that price of oil, at least for the time being. And of course, the real goal is to get you out of your car. They're going to raise the price of electricity. Electricity rates are going up dramatically later this year and next year. Why? Well, they want you to cut back. They want you to conserve. Conservation is the cry, the rallying cry. We've got to conserve. We've got to conserve. How do you get the people to conserve? The stupid people won't do it on their own, so we'll just raise the prices. We'll find one or another excuse to raise the price of electricity. And pretty soon they won't be able to afford to have on their air conditioning and their air, their electric heat and other things of that sort. And they're going to have to comply with the wishes of our unelected rulers. And I really believe that we're going to see a progressive grinding down of the living standards. The average American, in fact, recent studies have shown that the average 30-year-old man is making far less today when it suddenly adjusted for inflation than he was 20 years ago. But people shake their heads and they don't understand how these things are happening. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's not happening by accident, rather, but by intent. So you pick up the story there. And again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question for Melody, if you have any concern about what's going on economically in our country today. Go ahead, Melody.
I was going to comment on your about the men in their 30s are making less than their fathers after adjusted for inflation. And only in 1994, men in their 30s earned 5% more than their fathers did. So, I mean, that wasn't that long ago. So what's happening is happening rapidly. And that study was based on the Census Bureau figures. And there was a 12% drop compared with $40,000 per year for men in the same age group in 1974. So, yes, the standard of living is rapidly declining. The American dream is no longer. And when we look to the future and we see the baby boomers beginning to retire in 2008, and that's a topic you don't hear very much about. That's usually just pushed because there's going to be major problems when that begins to happen, and that starts next year. Will that happen January 1st? Probably not, but we will see baby boomers beginning to retire, and that will also have an impact on the market. Plus, a lot of these baby boomers, their dollars they won't be stretched with the rate of inflation. Their savings, perhaps they saved $800,000 to retire on, but their purchasing power has dropped. So will they be able to retire in 2008, or are they going to have to work a little bit longer, or are they going to have to pick up a part-time job? Well, when we look at our jobs and the availability, and everyone out there is having it difficult finding a job or replacing the one that they've lost at the same rate of pay that they had, there's going to be an overabundance of applicants, but they already have that in some of these low-paying jobs. So fundamentals for gold to rise and silver to rise, they haven't changed. Just because we've seen a little bit of a pullback. In fact, we're only down a little over 9% from a year ago when gold hit 720, 730. So we've had a little bit of a pullback, but the way you hear about it on mainstream is that, the plug has been pulled and you're going to see, 400 gold. That's just not going to happen. I mean, I don't have a crystal ball, but the risk in gold is the least amount of any other investment out there. So gold is still very much in its bull market. We just haven't seen anything yet, and they will continue to manipulate it as long as they can. But once the physical buying overtakes their ability to manipulate, then we will see prices rise. And the dollar coming into this time of year when you have things are a little bit on the slow side, if you have a weak currency, it'll show a little bit of strength this time of the year. You might see a little bit of strength going through August, but what we've seen so far in the dollar, it doesn't have a whole lot of energy, and it doesn't seem that it will be doing much. So come fall, again, it'll be put under extreme pressure. That is, if nothing else happens in the meantime. There's always that something coming from the left field that everyone isn't expecting, that can, like a hurricane or anything can happen to change what is going on with the dollar and the gold prices. So the best thing to do is don't wait and begin, take control, make a decision, and begin to prepare.
Well, as I said, we know that the Arab countries are continuing to buy up gold quietly. We know, of course, that China is increasing its share of its reserves in gold, and so is Russia, and apparently Brazil as well. These countries realize, of course, that fiat currencies always eventually revert to their true value, which is zero. In other words, there's nothing behind them. And, of course, certainly we can see what's happening in Rhodesia today, the government we installed there under Mugabe. Their inflation rate is 3,700% a year. 3,700% a year. And that 3,700% a year. And so you get an inflation rate of about 3,000% a month. And a lot of times the people who work, the teachers can't afford to go to school to teach because the transportation is too expensive. And people, of course, hardly wait. You know, they get their paycheck, the wife comes and picks it up, goes out and buys things, because, of course, tomorrow they're going to cost a lot more. Unbelievable, it's actually happening in the government that was brought to power by Henry Kissinger, the same man who's directing foreign policy and domestic policy here in America today, along with Zygmunt Brzezinski and, of course, David Rockefeller. But I'm sure that they're now worried. They understand what's happening. They're going to protect themselves, but they're not going to tell the American people.
Prices will not go down. Prices will continue to rise, which is the dollar, the currency falling. And it's sometimes it is hard. I understand how difficult it can be for people to realize the, because everything does seem fine. Things just keep moving along. You know, things just seem to go on without a hitch. But if you really look at what's keeping the hitch together, and we're right back to the debt. We're looking back at the individual who has been living on credit card debt. I've been talking about survival debt for 2 years now, how they use their credit card debt in order to pay their bills. And then they don't even see, or they don't understand the fees that are involved, the rate of interest. They don't have fixed rates anymore on their credit cards. So, you know, they can adjust them. The credit card banks can adjust them at their whim.
What's really happening? I've heard, you know, just sort of rumors about the credit card interest rates going up to 18 to 22, 25%. What's really happening to credit card interest rates? Have you been following that at all?
Well, I saw a quick article today. I haven't. I saw an article where they were talking about 32% on these cards, that because they entice these people in on a 0%, so people will flip their one credit card to another that they think is they're going to get 0%, and as soon as that time frame is up, then they're getting hit with I've seen 20, 25, 32% rates, and with tremendous privilege fees in order to borrow the funds, or, you know, you write those checks and, you know, they have $150 fees, and, you know, people believe as long as they can keep paying those monthly bills, even if it is a minimum, you know, that they're staying ahead of the game, and they don't worry about, if the husband is in a car accident and breaks his leg and can't go to work. So, I mean, I don't even believe it's paycheck to paycheck anymore. It's credit card to credit card. Because they're using their credit cards for all this, for the survival debt, for their survival, for their food, for the gasoline, for their children's school, for supplies.
Well, you know, I think what's so interesting is the fact that they are massively increasing the credit card interest rate. Now, what impact will that have? This is designed to stop people from actually purchasing so much on credit. They are trying to slow down our economy because it's obviously overheated. Of course, the reason it's overheated is because they're in just pouring the money out. We're pouring the money out. The United States, Japan, Canada, every country in the world is pouring money out except perhaps Germany and a few of the European countries trying to act responsibly. But eventually, of course, this begins to spill over into their nations as well. But all this money is out there. You can borrow it. You can then buy a house. You can buy a car. So this money is readily available. But according to Bob Chapman, I think he's probably right, because he's certainly relying upon material that comes out of Carlyle. And remember, Carlyle Corporation is one of the organizations very, very close to the centers of power in America. James Baker III, George A. Herbert Walker Bush, Frank Carlucci, Henry Kissinger, they're all tied to Carlyle. Carlyle says that the liquidity will last for about a year and a half and then begin to disappear. And when that happens, why, you hang on to your hat, because then money's not going to be available and you're going to owe all this money and there's not going to be any money to pay it off with. That's when, of course, push comes to shove, and it's like playing musical chairs. I mean, you keep running around the room, and the music stops, and you get a chair. There's chairs for everybody. And then there are not quite enough chairs for everybody. And then pretty soon, you got 100 people running around the room, and you got two chairs, and when the music stops, 98% of the people are standing there with no chair. And that's what's going to happen a few years from now, as they begin to contract the of this. And when credit contraction begins, why, we'll see some very, very dramatic changes. So, Melody, do you have any thoughts there at all?
Buy gold and lots of it.
Let's get your telephone number and your webpage out one more time.
The phone number is 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. And the website is discountgoldandsilvertrading.net. and make sure you spell out the A-N-D, Discount Gold and Silver Trading .net. And if anybody would like to send me an email regarding their portfolio or questions or comments, you can direct them to Discount Gold and Silver at yahoo.com. Discount Gold and Silver at yahoo.com. But the fundamentals for gold have not changed, and we touched on them all this evening. We, you know, all the global currencies, they're fiat currencies. They're all major currencies are not backed by gold, silver, or any other commodity. You're going to have an increase in investors. Demand is going to increase. People will want to look for a safe investment from stocks and bonds. You have all our geopolitical tensions around the world, which always puts risk on oil prices. You have China, you have gold and silver as money, our financial problems. I mean, the list just continues. We have a limited supply of commodities around the world. You have China. India is soon to replace China's beat China's population, so India will have a larger population than China. They're going to continue to buy all the commodities because they will need them to support their infrastructures. You know, they do work on their infrastructures. We have our markets, the derivative time bombs. We have so all the fundamentals are there. You have and there isn't one of them that's being addressed. And I don't think they can address them. I think the systems will have to purge, and those are. It was always the globalist plan to create a one-world government, and this is just a part of putting everything into place.
Well, I really think that they intend to create financial chaos. I really do. I think that is how they hope that they're going to be able, of course, to then force everybody into their economic system that they want. And, of course, when the people are impoverished, when there is no hope at all, then will come this one world leader who will offer them peace and prosperity. And they will cry, peace, peace, and prosperity for everyone. And everybody, of course, will follow this new one world leader who is coming down the line. And I don't think it's really that far away. Everything points in that direction. But I think that people have to understand that you cannot continue doing what we've done economically. You cannot continue, you know, spending as a nation more than you're taking in indefinitely. There is no way that Medicare is going to survive. There is no way that Social Security is going to survive. There is no way that our safety net that we have here in the United States is going to survive. There's no way that the companies are going to be able to pay off the pensions that they promised, whether it be the airlines or states, municipalities. And, of course, many of these companies are just going to dump their pensions onto the federal government. There's a public guarantee, pension guarantee corporation, which is fine, and they have funds to take care of that eventuality, unless too many of the major corporations just divest themselves of their pension funds, and then everybody who's supposed to get their pensions will find out, of course, how much you can trust the government. There's no way, of course, that they can possibly pay off all the pension funds for all the airlines and for all the corporations that have underfunded pensions. We're in for a very, very difficult ride. Our guest has been Melody. Good night, Melody. God bless.
Good night, Dr. Stan. Thank you.
All right. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and, of course, if you'd be interested in knowing what I really believe, I think you need to perhaps see the talk we gave about a year ago called Financial Tsunami. We have it, it's on a DVD, it's on video, and it comes with a syllabus, and it gives you a pretty good idea of what's going on out there. And all of the various factors coming together, whether it be the hedge fund market or the derivative market or the collapsing housing market or the exploding price of oil or simply the problems we're going to have as we intensely transfer our factories overseas, as we intensely transfer our jobs overseas, as they carry out the master plan of the Earth Summit for equitable distribution of wealth within nations and between nations, which really means we got a plan, we're going to impoverish the American people. This is pretty well described in his financial tsunami syllabus and, of course, article and talk. And then, of course, we have a little booklet called The History of Money. And you got to understand there's nothing new under the sun. They tried the same things back in ancient Greece and Rome and Florence and Venice and of course, the history of this effort to make prosperity through fiat money was tried in France following the French Revolution, in America during the Civil War, and, of course, in Germany, the Weimar Republic. And they're trying it in Rhodesia today, and you never guess what? It just isn't working. You can't print yourself into prosperity, but of course you can print yourself into chaos. So if you'd like more information, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Certainly one of my favorite books on this subject is called The Creature from Jekyll Island, Professor Sutton's excellent book, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, or Fiat Money, Inflation in France. All three books are classics explaining what fiat money is about. And if you need more information on any subject, why, I suggest you go to our website, RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. And then, of course, you can listen to our programs there. You can see all the various items we suggest are important for people to have to understand what's happening medically, what's happening economically, what's happening spiritually. Because behind everything that's going on today are powerful spiritual forces. If you have not yet seen my talk, Brotherhood of Darkness, or read the book, if you have not yet watched my talk on the Forbidden Secret, or my talk on Iraq, the Untold Story, which is really the history of wars, the histories of wars going back for over a century. Let me suggest this is important. And of course, many of these things come with syllabuses that give you the documentation that nothing that is going on today is happening by accident, that there really are people who control things from behind the scenes. I think one of the most shocking things we offer are the pages from Woodrow Wilson's book, The New Freedom, written back in 1913, when he talks about, you know, since I entered politics, men have come to me privately. Some of the biggest men in America are afraid of someone's something. They know there's a power somewhere so organized, so subtle, so watchful, so interconnected, so complete, so pervasive, that they had best not speak above their breath when they speak in condemnation of it. I'm quoting the President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson. You can read that, of course, in his own book. And since the book's out of print, we put it together, and you'll find it in many of our syllabuses. The name of the book, The New Freedom. A power so powerful that these men, the biggest men in America, are afraid to speak of it above their breath when they speak in condemnation of it. Get the facts, help us to get the information out. And pray for America. Pray for revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. And so, well, we'll be back in just a few moments for the next hour here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming here from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. The views of our guest, and of course our guest for this hour, is Mr. William Grigg, formerly the chief editor of the New American. Was that your official capacity? What was it, William?
Actually, it was senior editor.
Senior editor, okay.
Somebody who answered to an editor-in-chief.
All right, fine. Well, anyway, senior editor for New American. We enjoyed his articles over a period of many years, and now, of course, he's certainly available to us here, and we hope to have him on as often as we can. Because William Grigg is one of the most insightful people observing what's going on in the world that I know. And I heard him give a speech about a week and a half ago in Southern California. And I'm not easily impressed, but I was very impressed by what he had to say about the growing police power of the state over the individual and the fact that in many instances, many of our police do not respect the rights of the individual. Now, of course, this doesn't mean we don't have a lot of good police officers, but the police are being schooled in the idea that it's us against them. And, of course, we've got to do what we got to do to put the bad guys down without realizing that many times, of course, they're coming after innocent people, and many times they actually use undue force or even kill innocent people because, of course, they're just trying so hard to get the bad guys, and then they'll plant evidence, falsify statements. The morality that once, of course, characterized the American police seems to be gone, but then what would you expect when we've taken God out of our schools and anything goes, and look at what goes on in Washington, D.C., is what happens to the local police force really any worse than what happens in Washington, D.C., where our officials will lie to us about events and reason for things being done? Well, William, why don't you go ahead and pick up the story, and what concerns you about what's going on?
Dr. Monteith, first of all, I really appreciate your kind comments. Very generous of you. I really enjoyed our trip to California and the chance to address UROC and the opportunity to meet you in person. It's been quite a while since I've been on the radio with you, and it was a real blessing to meet you in person and get to hear your very insightful comments about some of the things going on in the esoteric realm. With reference to what's going on in the tangible world of law enforcement, there are a number of trends that I find really disturbing, and I think those trends have been fully consummated. The burden of my remarks in Southern California, and also in the book that I just completed, which is tentatively entitled From Republic to Reich, How the Imperial Executive Devoured the Bill of Rights, is these trends have consummated our transformation into a functioning police state, which is not to say that in terms of the expression of those tendencies were as bad as communist Cuba or North Korea or some of the other contemporary despotisms that we can look at or some of the historic examples, the most obvious being Soviet Russia and Nazi Germany. We're not there yet. But in terms of the power that the government claims, everything is in place and the institutions are ready, and we are living in a functioning police state, albeit one that has not yet reached the full flower of its malignancy.
Yeah, I think people really must understand that, and certainly since the 11th of September of 2001, why the executive branch of our government has really gutted the very foundation of our nation, certainly by the series of laws that seem to be intent upon expanding police power at every level and suspending the rights of the Fourth Amendment and the Fifth Amendment and habeas corpus, the very foundations upon which our freedom has existed for 200 years. We'll be right back with Mr. Grigg. William, why don't you go ahead and pick up the story there?
Sure.
Go right ahead.
Well, the biggest issue that I have right now in terms of what the executive branch has done post 9/11 is that in October of last year, October 17th to be specific, there were two enactments that were signed by George W. Bush that have received a great deal of attention, but nowhere near the sustained attention I think they deserve. The first was the enactment of the Military Commissions Act, which effectively destroyed habeas corpus, which is the foundational due process guarantee of the Anglo-Saxon common law tradition. When Magna Carta was issued in 1215, perhaps the most important demand that was urged upon King John by the barons at Runnymede was the writ of habeas corpus, which in Latin means you have the body or present the body. And digested to its essence, that principle holds that government cannot detain somebody without justifying before a judge or a competent magistrate the detention. There has to be a plausible criminal charge or a plausible indictment levied against an individual in order to justify that person's detention or incarceration prior to trial. If you don't have habeas corpus, on the other hand, somebody can be summarily imprisoned for no good reason without any legal recourse. And under the Military Commissions Act, those who would be designated enemy combatants or terror suspects would be deprived of habeas corpus and subject to trial by a military tribunal that would be under the president's jurisdiction, which is another real abomination. You really cannot have a judicial system over which the United States government would claim control and authority that answers to the president of the United States, as opposed to answering to the Supreme Court of the United States with the appellate exceptions that are outlined in Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution, specifically permitting the Congress to withdraw from the appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court and other federal courts certain matters that would be deemed suitable by Congress. You don't have that with the military tribunals, just as you don't have the habeas corpus guarantee for those who would be arraigned before them as suspected terrorists or unlawful combatants. And that applies primarily to people of foreign citizenship, those who are not U.S. citizens. And so a lot of people have considered this to be no particular problem because it wouldn't initially apply to American citizens. But Thomas Jefferson pointed out early in his first term as president that habeas corpus is a principle that applies to everybody over whom the United States government claims jurisdiction. It doesn't matter whether they're citizens or non-citizens. And of course, the extension of that quite sound principle is that if you deny it to non-citizens, eventually citizens will find themselves caught in the coils of this system where they wouldn't have the habeas corpus.
Hold that thought right there, please. We'll be right back. Well, go right ahead with him, and I think they're talking about habeas corpus, the fact that, you know, if we say, well, the take away habeas corpus is only for non-citizens, why, of course, sooner or later, once we've accepted that principle, why it will be expanded to everybody.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
And as a matter of fact, under the Military Commissions Act, or MCA, if you're a U.S. citizen who is accused of terrorism or consorting with terrorists, or being an unlawful combatant in some capacity, you can be arraigned by those courts and denied habeas corpus protection. That's actually happened in a couple of cases here in the United States involving people who have dual citizenship or who are United States citizens who have been found in some circumstance to be involved with people the United States government considers to be terrorists. There are cases involving people like Yasser Hamdi, and a couple of others. There's one case, and I'm trying to remember the name of the specific individual involved, but there was one case where the Bush administration tried to turn over to Iraqi custody a U.S. citizen who was accused of being involved in some kind of criminal activity in Iraq. I believe it was a kidnapping plot involving a Romanian diplomat. And I can't remember, once again, the name of the defendant here. But he was held in U.S. military custody, and he's a U.S. citizen who was born in Jordan, and he was in Iraq, if I remember correctly, trying to do business as a contractor of some sort or another. He was accused of involvement in this plot to kidnap a Romanian journalist, and the Bush administration wanted to turn him over to Iraqi custody for trial before an Iraqi court that was based, of course, on Islamic Sharia law. And he would have this defendant, this U.S. citizen, none of the protections and immunities to be found in our legal system, such as they are now. I mean, at least there's some residue of our common law heritage in our legal system for all of its flaws. And the Bush administration was perversely determined to turn this guy over to Iraqi authorities for trial, which means that he would probably be sentenced to death summarily without having even the semblance of a trial as we would understand it. That's more or less the type of the system we're talking about here in terms of the complete absence of protections, immunities, of rights that the Military Commissions Act would represent. And it would be able to impose the death penalty. And the president, once again, would be the ultimate appellate official here, not a judge. And Congress wouldn't be able to review the decisions either or withhold from appellate jurisdiction any of the rulings of this court. It would serve as its own review body. A few years ago, about 10 years ago, I was one of many people on the right who loudly and vehemently objected to the UN's so-called International Criminal Court, because the ICC would be involved in kidnapping people and putting them on trial where hearsay and double hearsay would be admissible evidence. They would not have the means to compel witnesses in their defense or to produce evidence in their defense. They would not have the right against self-incrimination. They could be sentenced to life imprisonment on the basis of testimony and evidence that would not make the cut here in American courts. They would be subject, the rulings of this court would be subject to review only by the same court that would issue the decision. All these things were abominations from the Western Anglo-Saxon perspective that the United States justice system is supposed to represent. Now, so I helped create a documentary intended to illustrate the dangers of the UN's International Criminal Court, and I still think that the ICC is a terrible idea and a very, very large potential danger. But the problem is everything that I objected to with respect to the United Nations International Criminal Court, the Bush administration is doing in the name of the war on terrorism.
That fact that was included in the Military Commission Act, where, of course, it not only lost the habeas corpus, but they could use hearsay testimony.
Yes.
And that was really one of the most frightening things. This would never be allowed in American courts.
Yeah, and not only that, but testimony that is extracted through torture.
Right.
Which is something else that is part of the whole process here of transforming our country from a free republic into something akin to a badly corrupted empire, which is what the word Reich means. But the MCA, the Military Commissions Act, was passed and signed on October 17th. That was one of the two enactments that I found really abhorrent. The second was a revision to the Insurrection Act that effectively dispensed with posse comitatus. The Posse Comitatus Act was passed in the 1870s to bring to an end the military occupation of the conquered South after the war between the states. And posse comitatus is a measure that forbids the use of active duty military within the boundaries of the United States as a law enforcement body. You cannot have the military get involved actively in law enforcement in the United States. Well, under the Insurrection Act, which was amended last fall, the President of the United States can take active control over the National Guard units of all 50 states, deploy them within the United States as he sees fit in order to deal with insurrections or civilian catastrophes, crises, whether domestic or whether natural or man-made, or to deal with what are described as combinations, which is an interesting term. Combinations would refer to groups of people deemed by the president to be unlawful assemblies for the purpose of undermining public order. And so he would have, presumably, the discretion to define as combinations any movement or organization that he was displeased with, and on the basis of a state of emergency, use the National Guard as his personal police force, which is a terrifying concept. It would essentially become a Praetorian Guard, the private executive enforcement arm of an imperial presidency. I've actually lived in a country for about 9 months. I was in Guatemala in 1983 during a state of martial law when Efrén Ríos Montt was evicted from power and the military took over. And I know what a country looks like when it's under military occupation, when the military is acting as a law enforcement arm. It's not a pretty sight. There was a lot of casual corruption before the coup that removed Ríos Montt. And after Efrén Ríos Montt was removed, the military took over, and bodies started simply to appear in the streets. And it was probably a pretty efficient way of doing what had been done inefficiently prior to the coup, I think is the best way of describing it. And the rationale here was that Efrén Ríos Montt was too corrupt and too distracted to deal with the crisis of terrorism provoked by the the long-standing civil war between the Guatemalan government and a communist insurrection. And the communists, of course, are very, very nasty people. But I suspect that it was a case of using them as a pretext in order simply to seize control on behalf of a ruling oligarchy that was backed by the CIA. Efrain Rios Montt was definitely backed by the CIA. I think they just pulled the chain on him and put in the military for a brief interregnum and then started up again to somebody who was a less overtly corrupt person than General Montt had been. But that's the sort of thing we're talking about here when the military takes over and becomes the law enforcement arm of a government. And the fact that they would be at the beck and call of a president who would be able to exercise extraordinary powers, to define anybody as an enemy combatant and summarily imprison or torture or even kill that person is a very terrifying prospect indeed, one entirely foreign to our established history of liberty under law through constitutional government.
You know, I think the important thing, William, is the fact that the military is not trained for police action.
No.
The military is trained to kill people and destroy things, and that is its function, and that is as it should be. That is a terrible thing to say, but that's what war is about.
Yep.
The police are trained, of course, to take care of the people, to provide for the people, to maintain law and order. Increasingly, they are being militarized. They're militarizing our police and training them in military tactics and providing them with military equipment. But then, on top of that, to add insult to injury, to do away with the posse comitatus law,
mm-hmm.
so the president could use the United States military against American citizens. Why would anybody who believes in freedom, in our Constitution, in our way of life, want to do that? Is that how we're going to fight Osama bin Laden sitting over there in a cave?
It's really an interesting thing when you consider the fact that Osama bin Laden, who's been identified as the grand mastermind behind 9/11 and practically every other evil thing that has happened since roughly 1997 or so, Osama bin Laden is somebody who had been cultivated by our intelligence agencies and somebody who had been on relatively friendly terms with Western intelligence agencies until well into the 1990s. And I think it's interesting when you take a look at the aggregate body count here. And this is something that I point out in the first chapter of my book, is that during the period of time since the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, if you take a look at the number of people who were killed by terrorism, you're dealing with a minuscule number that's roughly the same as the number of people who were killed by accidents involving allergies to peanuts, for instance, and such things. Terrorism is a horrible thing. When it occurs to innocent people and is widely broadcast, that becomes a force multiplier that creates this sense of existential threat that really isn't proportionate to the level of the threat as measured in actual tangible terms. And so you end up with people like Osama bin Laden, who are depicted as these omnicompetent James Bond villain-type figures, who really pose a threat markedly less, I contend, than that posed by the government that rules over us, that at one point had been Osama bin Laden's ally or partner. At least it existed in some kind of symbiosis with him back in the 1980s and early 1990s. The thing is, while the foreign face of the enemy may change and the insignia of our foreign enemies may change from time to time, and the Hitler of the month may be a different figure every one of the 12 calendar months, I contend that the mailing address of our most deadly enemy never changes. That mailing address is in Washington, D.C. That's the government that taxes us, the government that rules us, that regiments our lives, that spends our wealth and our hard-earned industrial treasure on pointless ventures like the Iraq War, and claims the power now to imprison any of us summarily at the whim of the president.
Well, I think we really should be very caused a concern when, of course, we remember on the 20th of September of 2001, just a few days after the September 11th attack, the President of the United States announced in his address to the nation that the United States was the largest provider of humanitarian aid for Afghanistan for the year 2001. Well, that's, of course, the Taliban. Why were we financing the Taliban? We're hosting and giving refuge to the wicked Osama bin Laden.
Mm-hmm. Well, very good question. I think that
Go right ahead.
Well, one of the things about the situation with the Taliban that I find really provocative is that after September 11, you heard from George W. Bush and Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, if I remember correctly, the common story that they had hard, actionable intelligence, basically warrant court caliber evidence against Osama bin Laden as the protagonist and mastermind of the plot to conduct the September 11 terrorist attack, and that they would present it to the public. Well, they still haven't. Here we are, almost 6 years after that event, and they have yet to demonstrate, they have yet to provide to the public this supposedly clinching, convincing evidence that Osama bin Laden was indeed the individual who orchestrated that terror plot. I'm receptive to the idea that he might have been, but as of yet, the Bush administration has never demonstrated as much. And the Taliban junta in Afghanistan, after Osama bin Laden had been identified as the mastermind of 9/11, very reasonably, even monsters like the Taliban are capable of reason, said to the Bush administration, let us see your evidence. And the Bush administration didn't deign to do so. And I've been asked often, what would you have done, seeing as how I'm such a voluble critic of the war in Iraq and the general so-called war on terrorism, how would you have responded to 9/11? And what I've said is, if they actually had evidence about Osama bin Laden being the mastermind and he was being given safe harbor by the Taliban regime in Afghanistan, show them the evidence and present them with the same ultimatum. Here's the evidence. We are convinced to a moral certainty that Osama bin Laden is the one who attacked us. Surrender him to our custody within a date certain, or else I, as the President of the United States, George Bush would say in my scenario, will go to the Congress and request a declaration of war against your country, and we will remove you by force. I would be willing to bet that if they had done so, the Afghans would have coughed up Osama bin Laden very quickly, which is why it wasn't done, I contend, because bin Laden was simply too valuable as a totem of evil to bring about his actual capture by Washington. That would have ended his usefulness as sort of this Emmanuel Goldstein figure in this whole psychodrama that we're living through. But the Taliban, as it happens, in the weeks leading up to 9/11, had actually tried to turn over Osama bin Laden to the Bush administration. We hear an awful lot from Republican Party lickspittles like Sean Hannity about the delinquencies of Bill Clinton in failing to get a hold of Osama bin Laden before his lamentable reign came to an end in 2001. But the fact is that the Bush administration had the same opportunity up to and including the weeks leading up to 9/11, and they didn't take that opportunity despite frantic efforts by the Taliban to do so. So yeah. I think that that aspect of what's going on here in terms of cultivating and perpetuating this sense of threat by Osama bin Laden is sort of a psychological foil for the efforts to militarize our domestic law enforcement and to make government an all-pervasive influence in our lives in the name of protecting us from a very marginal threat, which is the threat of terrorism. I think that's a very important element of this whole equation. They have to have somebody who seems to be a larger-than-life threat who can be shaken at us from time to time so as to keep us docile and manipulate us into supporting these impositions on our liberty.
Well, of course, the question is, why, after Osama bin Laden had escaped into Pakistan, didn't we either give Pakistan a threat, give us Osama bin Laden, or we're going to invade your country, or simply invade their country? After all, we invaded Afghanistan to get Osama, but never Pakistan, and we have to ask, why? Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is William McGrigg. William, please pick up the story.
Well, you'd ask why we didn't invade Pakistan after Osama bin Laden escaped through Tora Bora. And, of course, there's reason to believe he's read the book Jawbreaker, which is one really good source. I can't remember the name of the author. He was somebody who had been in charge of one of the efforts by the CIA and Special Forces to track down bin Laden in Afghanistan. His narrative leaves it pretty clear that bin Laden was permitted to escape from Afghanistan into Pakistan. Why didn't we pursue him into Pakistan? Why didn't we invade Pakistan? A couple of potential reasons, one of them obvious, occurs to me, the first of which is that Pakistan is a nuclear power, and it's not been the practice of Washington to invade or otherwise molest nuclear-armed regimes since the beginning of the atomic age back in the 1940s. That's one difference. If you take a look at the difference between, say, the way that the Bush administration has dealt with with Iraq and contrasted it with the way it's dealt with North Korea. I think it's obvious that one reason they've not been as assertive with North Korea is that North Korea has nukes. And, of course, the fellow in charge of the North Korean junta seems like just the sort of a person who'd use them. If you take a look at the people who were invaded during the 1990s, you have, well, starting in 1989, you had Panama, and then Iraq, and after Iraq you had Somalia, Haiti. There were bombing operations against the Bosnian Serbs in 1994-1995. You had attacks on Sudan and Afghanistan in 1998. You had the bombing, 78-day bombing of Yugoslavia over the Kosovo matter in 1999. All of these are non-nuclear powers. Pakistan is not a non-nuclear power. Pakistan is an Islamic country with atomic capacity. And so I think that invading Pakistan is something that Washington would have little appetite for. But beyond that, if you take a look at the client relationship that Musharraf has with Washington, it's pretty clear that not only Musharraf, but the ISI, the Pakistani equivalent of the CIA, which basically cultivated, funded, and created the Taliban and did more than a little bit to create the criminal syndicate called Al-Qaeda, it's pretty clear that if the Bush administration really wanted to exercise influence with what is basically a puppet client state, it could do so on any given day of its choosing, which lends, I think, a certain credibility to my idea that Osama bin Laden is there and is luxuriating in relative safety because the Bush administration wants Osama bin Laden, assuming that he's still alive, wants Osama bin Laden to be an ever-present threat, to keep in the background this low hum of menace that is used to disarm Americans psychologically and lead us into the embrace of the police state.
Because one of my favorite statements is, if you really believe Osama bin Laden was responsible for what happened on September 11th, then go to your computer and Google in FBI 10 Most Wanted. You'll get the picture of Osama bin Laden, but if you read what he's wanted for, he's not wanted for the attack on the World Trade Center. He's wanted for the attack on the American embassies in Tanzania and Kenya, but not one mention of September 11th. Now, the question is, maybe is it a typographical error? Is it that the FBI isn't smart enough to know that the Bush administration has the goods on Osama bin Laden? Or is it possibly that the Bush administration really doesn't have the goods on Osama bin Laden? But why is it that Osama bin Laden is not being searched down, at least by the FBI, for his involvement there? You can do that. Do it tonight.
Sure.
They may change it tomorrow, but of course, I think it's important you understand that the FBI doesn't believe Osama bin Laden was involved in 911.
That's true. And last I checked, they still have that same wanted poster with that same conspicuous omission. And while I'm sure no man ever went broke by betting against the competence of the FBI, it would seem to me that this is one instance in which the FBI may have the story right.
Right.
They have never been, from what I know, they have never been presented with the key clinching evidence that would document the standing of Osama bin Laden as the prime suspect of the 9/11 attacks.
Well, if that's really true, then he wasn't involved, the prime suspect, why did we invade Afghanistan and kill all those people? And then why did we invade Iraq and kill all those people? Is it possibly it was just all an awful mistake?
Oh, I'm betting against the mistake thesis.
I would as well. And I think, ladies and gentlemen, what you must understand is the American people are not being told the truth. I want you to go up on the Internet. I want you to Google in FBI 10 Most Wanted and follow the path to Osama bin Laden and read what the FBI says about why they want Osama. And ask yourself, could this really be true? Is it really possible that we have been lied to, that all those people who died and are continuing to die in the Middle East today, it's all unnecessary? Well, William, go right ahead there with your story.
Well, the thing that I think is the salient consideration regarding Afghanistan and Iraq here is the most obvious question. I'd like to say Will Griggs' first law of analysis is never ignore the obvious. And the most obvious thing that strikes me about that region of the world is the energy equation. And you're dealing in Afghanistan with an area that's not necessarily energy rich, but is a strategic potential trade route regarding, or pipeline route rather, regarding the export of oil from Soviet Central Asia, what used to be called Soviet Central Asia, and the whole Persian Gulf region, which includes Iraq, is the world gas station. And it seems to me that it's obvious that the power elite behind the Bush administration, which is not confined entirely to people in Washington and New York City, but also places like London, for instance, are interested in monopolizing that region to have political control over the world's critical energy resources. One of the things that people keep asking, and this is a line which is peddled by Rush Limbaugh, to no one's surprise, it's something which is both a glittering generality and a really interesting nugget of pure stupidity. What Rush Limbaugh says is, okay, if you're convinced that these evil oil men staged this war for oil, why are gas prices higher now by a considerable margin than they were before we attacked Iraq? To which, of course, the logical response would be a rhetorical question. Do you really think that people who are in the business of producing oil, petroleum, want to see the price go down? I mean, it seems to me to be counterintuitive that people who make a profit off of scarcity would want to bring about abundance as opposed to profiting off of artificial scarcity. And the world's oil and energy markets generally, this is something that the Economist of London, which is sort of a left-leaning, vaguely Fabian socialist publication, but occasionally gets some things right. This is one good example. Last August or September, the Economist magazine published an analysis of the world oil markets and the world oil producers. And they pointed out that out of the top 15 oil producers, 12 of them, if I remember correctly, were either owned or operated by governments, by national governments. And so you're dealing here with a market and a product that are both thoroughly controlled by the political sector, not by the market forces. And that pretty much it is exemplified by this squalid lump of evil called Dick Cheney. Here's somebody who, between 1993 and 2001, made a very handsome living as the CEO of an oil services company, a multifaceted...
Hold that there right there. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and William Grigg is our guest this evening, and we'll get back to what he was saying in just a moment, but before we do that, William, do you have a website out? Would you like to tell our listeners how they can get your books or your material?
Sure. I think that the best and easiest way to reach me is to go by way of the Right Source Online, and the web address for that is rightsourceonline.com, not the Right Source. The website is entitled The Right Source, but the web address is rightsourceonline.com, and that's a web portal that will take you to my blog, which is called Pro Libertate, which is Latin for freedom, and also an email magazine, a free online journal that we distribute through email or that's accessible through the site, which is also called Pro Libertate. And I've also started writing recently for the Muckraker Report, muckrakerreport.com, which is an investigative journal. And there's also another site, prolibertate.us, which has both the audio and transcripts of one-minute commentaries I do five times a week called Will Griggs Liberty Minute. That's prolibertate.us. So the two best addresses to remember are rightsourceonline.com and prolibertate.us.
All right, fine. Well, Chris Will was simply talking about Rush Limbaugh, who says, look, if you out there, you extremists out there, you fruitcakes out there, you know, who say that, you know, it was the oil men who were responsible for what's going on, you know, in the Middle East, then why is the price of oil going up? I mean, after all, if the oil men were behind this, why is the price of oil going up? And the answer is, of course, they want to make profits.
Yeah, I mean, the easiest way to make a profit is for somebody to snuggle up next to a government and create a cartel or an artificial monopoly. That goes way back to Adam Smith, where he talked about the man of system being a natural monopolist, and how if you get to, I'm trying to remember so I can paraphrase it as fairly as possible, but Adam Smith said something the substance of which was that you cannot have a group of merchants get together in a room without them conceiving some conspiracy against the public. The idea being that there's always this impulse toward restraint of trade and cartelization of a given marketplace. And the only way you can do that is if you enter into a corrupt union with government. And as I said before, I think one really good example of that would be the ambulatory sebaceous cyst that is Dick Cheney. During the decade of the 1990s, as the head of Halliburton, which is a multifaceted oil services company that also just recently spun off a military services affiliate, and they're involved in such things as building detention centers in the United States, putatively for illegal immigrants. They helped build the Gitmo facility back in the late 1990s on a contract from the Clinton administration, supposedly to detain Haitian immigrants. We know the uses to which that facility is being put now. But Halliburton is completely a creature of this bizarre concept called the public-private partnership, where a large corporate interest sort of snuggles up next to the government and starts getting these no-bid contracts to do certain tasks. Halliburton has profited famously off of such things as subsidies from the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, the Export-Import Bank, and they were very busy in the 1990s building up Iran's nuclear capacity and building up the nuclear capacity for Communist China, things of this sort. But they most famously are involved in the oil services industry. And George W. Bush, back in the late 1970s, when through the crepuscular haze of alcohol and drug abuse, he was trying to find something to do that didn't involve politics and getting elected to office. He was very briefly involved with Arbusto Energy, which was a remarkable venture in that he managed to drill all over Texas without hitting oil. And so he's somebody who has no particular aptitude for the private sector, nor does Dick Cheney, but they know very well how to manipulate politics in profitable ways. And it seems to me that staging the Iraq invasion and the, I would contend, necessary collateral operation of the invasion occupation of Afghanistan is very obviously part of the effort to cartelize on a global scale the crucial energy resources so as to have the means of keeping this whole mechanism of global power in operation. There are some people who believe, and I don't know how much credence I lend to this theory, that what pushed Saddam Hussein over the edge in terms of the decision to remove him from power in Iraq was that he was going to be opening up an oil burst that would be trading in some currency other than the dollar. And the dollar has been propped up by the Saudis now for a number of decades. They have been willing to take dollars in exchange for petroleum, and because the dollar has no legitimate value, it has no currency, it has no precious metal backing, it has no backing in terms of anything that people would take. It's just a fiat currency backed by the full faith and credit of the United States, which is basically zero. The Saudis have been willing to take the dollar in exchange for petroleum, and so basically the dollar is backed by the Saudi government's willingness to accept it for petroleum. It's the petrodollar. And if Saddam Hussein had opened up a euro-based oil market, this would undermine the dollar standing and bring the dollar crashing down, and with the crash of the dollar you'd see the end of American ascendancy as a world power and some really serious disruption of the entire international architecture of what is called the New World Order. And so supposedly Saddam Hussein was removed for that reason. I don't know if it's true. It certainly fit what we've seen in terms of the way he suddenly became a threat about the same time he started to discuss this option. Iran has opened up an oil burst that trades in euro, and it's interesting that since that has happened, and just since the beginning of this year, actually, you've seen a 20% decline in the value of the dollar against the euro. That's a remarkable development. If you'll forgive me for straying rather afield of our topic here to examine this for a minute, the euro is a fiat currency issued by a largely hypothetical political entity that has no history. If you take a look at the dollar, worthless as it is, at least the dollar is adorned with pictures of people who really lived and events that really happened, like the signing of the Declaration of Independence in Philadelphia on the back of a $2 bill. The euro is disfigured with pictures of people who never lived and buildings that have never existed, because the European Union is a largely fictitious entity. It's the union of these discrete governments that have histories and cultures and peoples and so forth. But the euro itself is just a fiat currency that's issued by a socialist government, and yet it is outperforming the dollar considerably because of the amount of debt that the United States government has run up and how we're monetizing the debt through through monetary inflation and so forth. And so the vulnerability of the dollar is one thing that people believe has been driving a lot of the interest in controlling the Middle Eastern energy reserves and other natural resources as a way of having something substantive in the possession of the Anglo-American power elite. I don't know if that's the case as well, but once again, it would certainly fit what's going on.
Go ahead.
Natural outgrowth of that domestically, of course, is what we're seeing with the domestic police state, where because the legitimacy of our rulers is so tenuous and the capacity for economic disruption is so large, and I believe that we're dealing with a possible severe economic hiccup here in terms of potential oil shock and other things like that that would cause the economy to have a sudden spasm, that we're seeing how very carefully the architecture of a domestic police state has been laid out. And that's the thing that I think haunts my sleep more than anything else, the prospect of some kind of a severe and sudden economic shock that creates a genuine public emergency here that's not related at all to terrorism, but will be looked upon by Washington and our ruling elite as a potential civic insurrection that would be used to justify the enactment the empowerment of all these decrees and setting into motion the militarized police as a way of putting down domestic disturbances in the name of public order. And you mentioned earlier in an earlier segment, Dr. Monteith, that there's been a critical change in perspective here in terms of how law enforcement views the public at large. I say that it's the shift in focus from the vision of to protect and serve to the vision of shock and awe, and how now law enforcement officers, both federal as well as state and local, are trained to look upon the public at large not as citizens with rights that have to be protected, but as potential criminals, or as criminals, actually, literal criminals. They're raw suspects in their eyes, and as an enemy that has to be subdued and dominated. That's a military mindset. When you change the hardware, you change the training, and change the mindset of people, and then you have local offices, local police offices and sheriff's departments increasingly funded out of Washington through the Department of Homeland Security and even by the Pentagon, you no longer have local law enforcement. You no longer have state and local police. You can no longer support your local police in that sense because they're no longer local. They're simply a local affiliate, a local franchise of a centralized Homeland Security state. And that's where we are right now in terms of the facts on the ground. It doesn't always manifest itself. It's manifesting itself increasingly with shocking frequency as SWAT teams are sent out to enforce, or sent out on the flimsiest of pretexts. Good heavens, they're used to raid underground poker parties, for heaven's sake. In Texas and elsewhere, you have the spectacle of ninja-clad stormtroopers with fully automatic weapons kicking in doors and throwing to the ground, face first on the ground, putting their boots on the back of the necks of people who are playing poker. I mean, that's just obscene. Or SWAT teams being used to serve warrants that have nothing to do with the hostage situations or with potential armed violence or any of the other pretext for which the SWAT concept was originally created back in the late 1960s. But that's paradigmatic of what's happening to law enforcement right now in terms of the change of mindset and the change of operating tactics and perspective. And now the Bush administration has said that to the extent any law enforcement agency receives so much as a nickel of federal funding, they're essentially federalized. And in the case of Joshua Wolf in San Francisco, he was a blogger who was thrown in jail for a rather long stretch because he refused to turn over footage of a riot in San Francisco a couple of years ago in which a police car was burned. Mr. Wolf contended that he had protection under California's Journalism Shield Law. The Bush administration said, no, that doesn't apply because the San Francisco Police Department automobile that was vandalized was federal property because the SFPD receive money through the Homeland Security Department, that money being fungible, everything that the SFPD owns could be considered federal property. That's a very important precedent, too, because what that means is that the Bush administration has effectively federalized every law enforcement agency in this country that has received any kind of Homeland Security assistance or any kind of Pentagon assistance as well, and can activate these as federal franchises, if you will, once again, whenever it strikes the president's fancy to do so.
And, of course, that by its very essence is unconstitutional.
Oh, sure.
The federal government, according to our Constitution, has no right to control the local police. I mean, in fact, we should not even have a federal police force. That was not the function of the federal government to have anything to do with the individual. Certainly, they were to defend themselves from foreign aggression, which they're not really doing.
No.
To defend themselves from invasion, which we're not really doing.
Of course not.
And yet, on the other hand, when it comes to interfering with the individual and tracking the individual and setting up dossiers on the individual, this is exactly what they are doing in violation of our own laws. They are tapping our telephones under echelon, and it has nothing to do with September 11th. They were doing it long before that.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Reading our emails and reading our faxes and violating our laws with impunity. This is done by the NSA, done by computers. And anybody who doubts that, go up on the computer, type in echelon in Google, and begin to read and understand a long-standing effort to track the American people, because there are people in Washington, D.C. who look upon the American citizen as the enemy.
Well, if you take a look at the way that the so-called war on terrorism is being waged, especially here within the borders of the United States, against whom are all these techniques being deployed, all these techniques of surveillance and scrutiny? Who is it who is molested every time we try to fly? It's us, it's the public at large. We are the suspects. We're not those who are being protected. We are those who are being regimented and treated as if we are liable to some form of prosecution or detainment. Or detention, rather, simply because of the fact that we're here, and presumably all of us could be considered unreliable. We've not really earned the trust of our rulers. It reminds me of that line from the Bertolt Brecht play back in 1953 about how the people has lost the confidence of the government, so the government should dissolve them and elect a new people. You know, that's sort of the same kind of totalitarian mindset we're dealing with right now, where in the war on terrorism, it's not that we're being protected from terrorists, it's that we're being treated as terrorists, or at least potential terrorists. And that brings up another subject that I talk about in my new book, which is the sudden proliferation starting about 8 or 9, 10 years ago of checklists and taxonomies of potential terrorists, the most notorious of which being, I think, the Megiddo Report, the Project Megiddo Report, which was put out by the FBI in 1999, talking about the potential for millennial terrorism associated with certain types of political and religious extremism. And right at the top of that list was the so-called super patriots, the people who believed, for instance, that our sovereignty had been compromised, that the United Nations represented a threat to our sovereignty and an impending world government. Basically, the sort of people who homeschool their children and believe in the right to keep and bear arms and so forth, they were the ones who were considered the most salient potential terrorist threat at the turn of the millennium. The threat of Islamic terrorism was rather down on the list, toward the bottom of it. And from that, you could see cloned off various terrorism checklists that were distributed, for instance, in Phoenix, Arizona. There was one that recently got some attention in Alabama. The state of Virginia had another one. All across the country, all these affiliates of the Homeland Security State have watch lists, or terror checklists, rather. That's a better way of describing it, where you're supposed to be on the lookout for people to display certain attitudes about government.
Oh, okay. Really, we actually have posted on my website the Phoenix checklist, and there's one way you can tell a terrorist, and he talks about the Constitution.
Sure.
I mean, if you can believe that was actually on that checklist, and this was distributed by the task force, the FBI task force on terrorism in the city of Phoenix.
Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it was the joint task force with the local U.S. attorney in the FBI's field office there. And I actually spoke with a counterterrorism official at FBI office who was rather disillusioned with what was going on. He said, yeah, this is obviously something that was inspired by the Megiddo Report. where they were isolating conservative Christians, particularly evangelical Christians who believe in the end times as the most fertile source of terrorism. And, of course, constitutionalists make that cut as well. And that, once again, takes me back to the days of Reconstruction in the post-Civil War era, where President Andrew Johnson, of all the unlikely people, said, whenever you hear a man talking about the Constitution, mark him down as a traitor. That's pretty much where we've come to today as well. Mark him down as a potential terrorist if they talk about the Constitution too much.
And yet, of course, all of these people have sworn to uphold the Constitution, so, obviously we should ask them the question, who then is the traitor?
Sure.
The person who's sworn to uphold the Constitution and doesn't believe in it, or the person who talks about it? And I think, of course, it should be pretty obvious that the people who swear they uphold the Constitution and then persistently work and vote to destroy it are traitors to our nation. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up tonight's program with Will Grigg. Well, Woody, we've got 3 minutes to finish up the program.
Right.
Go right ahead.
Well, I think that if we can take away anything useful from this discussion, I think the following points would be right at the top of the list. The first of which is that for the first time in our history, the President of the United States now has or claims the power, not the authority. Authority is legitimate power, limited by law and revocable if it's abused. The President of the United States claims the power, the usurped power, to use the National Guard units of all 50 states as his private Praetorian Guard, first of all, and secondly, to suspend the habeas corpus guarantee and summarily imprison anybody he considers to be an unlawful enemy combatant or terrorist suspect. That's something which is unprecedented in our history, and it's right out of the morphology of your classic police states and your classic dictatorships. The second thing I would take away from this discussion is some appreciation of the gravity of the federalization and militarization of our law enforcement. That's something that, once again, is without pressed in our history, as at least as is applied to the general population. These are not things that would strike American Indians as novel. If you take a look at some of the unfortunately shameful things that were done, particularly to the Plains Indians after the war between the states, not a whole lot of what we see in subsequent history of concentration camps and disarmament of civilian populations and so forth would be considered novel to the American Indians, at least those who study the history of that experience. But what we're seeing now is how that is more or less being used as a model for the population at large. There is an ongoing effort to bring about the fusion of the military and the police. There's been a change in mindset on the part of local law enforcement to where they're no longer really servants of the community in which they reside, but rather they're there for the purpose of maintaining order, not to establish the type of peace that comes from the tranquility of liberty under law, but rather to establish and vindicate the power of the government. And more and more frequently, you see local law enforcement agencies, including the police here in this tiny town of Payette, Idaho, where I live, adopting the mindset of controlling and dominating, shock and awe rather than protect and serve. And I think what's driving all of this is an agenda for global power that is going to require perpetual war and economic hardship, and because that's something we will not take to cheerfully, and chances are there's going to be some organized resentment against that agenda. I believe that the people who are the architects of this global system have decided that now is the proper time to fortify themselves by building and strengthening the rudiments of a police state, which are now all present.
We're going to have to let you go. We're out of time. God bless. Thanks so much.
God bless.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I do hope that many of you out there have enjoyed Will Grigg's commentary this evening. I think it was very insightful, and there's so much more to cover, and I do hope we can get Will back onto our programs here in the not-too-distant future on a regular basis. He certainly is one of the most insightful and best-informed people I've seen on this subject we talked about tonight. And you must understand, we're moving away from freedom towards fascism. Are you concerned? What are you willing to do? And of course, the first thing you have to do is understand our form of government and the separation of powers and the fact that the federal government was to have nothing to do with the local police, and that we have people in Washington, D.C. who have sworn to uphold our Constitution who hate it. because the Constitution limits their power over the lives of the people, and they have a different agenda because they worship a different God. And, of course, that takes us into the understanding of the esoteric actions and functions that are going on today. If you've not yet, of course, heard my story of the Brotherhood of Darkness, the book, the DVD, if you've not seen our latest DVD, the we actually have four tapes of The Secret Behind the Secret, and then, of course, we have a new DVD entitled Forbidden Secret. Forbidden Secret Religion will tell you the secret that has been passed down through the mystery religions for 5,000 years. And, of course, it is has to do with the New World Order, the New World Religion, certainly the New World Leader, and the fact that you can access power by, of course, coming into contact with the other dimension. And there's power there to be had, but, of course, the price of your eternal soul. So that is called The Forbidden Secret. Then, of course, you want to understand what's going on today with the programs being pushed by Oprah Winfrey and certainly by Larry King and by Jim Carrey and the others. That's the four-tape set or 4-CD set, The Secret Behind the Secret. To put things into perspective, let me suggest The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginnings. It's a DVD that won the Best Documentary of the Year award from the New York Film Festival last year. And then another DVD called Riddles in Stone. Now, I have a small part in both of them, a very small and insignificant. But my recurrent theme is this. There have always been two forces in America. One was the Christian, and the other was the occult. Initially, the Christian was predominant. Today, the occult is predominant. And, of course, the Christian influence is rapidly diminishing because many of our ministries have been infiltrated by people from the dark side. So we do hope that many of you will be interested in getting more information. You can go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. If you'd like more information, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And our message is this. We're involved in a spiritual battle that's being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, financial, economic battlefield. And if you don't understand the spiritual forces behind what's going on, then you're going to fall prey to them, as will millions of Americans at this time in history, and there is a great falling away from the Christian faith. And we are told that in 2 Thessalonians 2, that before the man of sin is revealed, there will become a great falling away. And we're also told, of course, that, you know, when Jesus was asked, what will be the signs of our coming? His reply was, as it was in the days of Noah. That's why you'll certainly want to see Chris Beddoe's excellent video, and soon to be in DVD, and it has to do with the Atlantis connection. Why? Because Atlantis, at least according to the occultists, was that great society that was here before the Great Flood, and they wish to reconstitute that society. The Atlantis connection is important. 1-800-544-8927. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.